we need to take into account the plasticity of the brain, because Helen pointed out that those who are blind, you know, congenitally blind, or born blind, then their kind of auditory kind of, you know, system seem to be activated. Sorry, the visual system seems to be active, you know, exactly. So although we may suppress this left prefrontal cortex, but then that function could be taken over by...
Just for the first part, and the second part is quite intriguing. For the first part, I think we more or less addressed that, because, you know, that smile, that silly smile tab, we really try to control that. I mean, just try to really generate compassion without smiling. And there's another state which we call open state. I mean, without really trying not to have any facial tension or movement, at least conscious one. And then there's another state which we'll call the open state that also gives a lot of gamma activation. And that is totally blend in terms of face. So, I mean, at least I don't know what Rishi will comment, but superficially, I think the face expression probably easy. Now, about knocking down a particular...
I was just saying that I was only using the face as an example, and I agree that you control for that. But it's only one of many things that we don't know that may be happening that might be causing it that are unrelated to it. And it's not that it's not that it's not true. It's not that it's not the linkage in there. It's just that these are methods that scientists use to prove that it must be that. It has to be that.
From the first-person experience, this thing of shifting on, off, I mean, it seems you are doing something about
it. That's good. Yeah. You
know, someone is there to switch it on and off.
What is it?
But not about stopping it. That would be interesting.
Yeah. Just to follow up on Rusty's comment, one of the other ways that scientists use to tease apart exactly the issue that Rusty described and Helen uses these methods is to take individuals who have damage to a specific part of the brain from natural causes, for example, from a stroke. And you would expect that certain kinds of stroke patients, based upon where their stroke is, should have more difficulty in cultivating compassion in this way compared to other stroke patients whose damage is elsewhere in the brain. And that's something that could be studied. I'm sure it hasn't been studied yet, but it could be.
Can you explain what the TMS method gets into? Is a temporary stroke in the motor cortex?
Well, there is a technique, Your Holiness, called transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS. And what TMS is, it is a very powerful magnet that can be used to externally stimulate the brain. And it can be particularly used to very temporarily, and for everything we now know, a safe way to decrease function in a particular area of the cortex just temporarily. It lasts on the order of minutes. And it may be possible to use TMS in an experimental way to see if we can produce these kinds of effects. Thought experiments.
His Holiness was earlier asking, do the experimental scientists make distinctions within the emotions between those that are instinctual, reactive, instinctual emotions, and those that can be actually cultivated and reasoned emotions?
Well, I would say that there's a distinction between emotions which are basic in the sense that they're present very early in life. They're present in every human being. Emotions like fear and disgust and happiness. Darwin, in his book in 1872, he wrote a book called The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals. And he gave extensive examples of the expressive signs of emotion that are present very early on in life and also in different species. Emotions like guilt and shame are more complicated emotions that require the development of some cognitive sophistication and don't emerge until later in development.
For example, like guilt and shame, you wouldn't expect that in animals now.
Right, nor would you expect it in very young infants.
Guilt. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so.
They show appeasement gesture.
So, Your Holiness, another topic which we talked a little bit about that we would love to hear your comments about is some of the information that I talked about this morning indicates that moderate amounts of adversity may promote resilience and have beneficial effects. And we were interested to hear your thoughts about what kind of adversity may actually be beneficial to promote these positive qualities. One of the things that we talked about is the context in which adversity occurs. And it may be that adversity in the presence of those who are very caring is one thing, but adversity, the same adversity, in the absence of that kind of caring may produce very different effects. But we were wondering if Your Holiness can just give us your thoughts about that.
Someone feels that. But the issue of resilience and the need for adversity in order to develop resilience, it's really difficult to, it's almost impossible to really say, you know, objectively that this much adversity is good and this much adversity is bad. It really seems to depend upon the state of mind of the individuals. It would really differ from individual to individual. For example, His Holiness was giving the example from the Buddhist tradition. In the Buddhist text, there are different mentalities or practitioners are recognized. And to some practitioners, the Buddha had said that there are three final liberations. So certain types of people will attain this, you know, this kind of liberation. Others will attain this kind of liberation, and others may attain full enlightenment. So, to those type of individuals, different types of teachings have been given. So similarly, in the Buddhist practice, meditation practice, there is a recognition of three different levels of suffering. So obvious sufferings, the evident sufferings that we can all recognize as painful experiences. And there is the suffering of change, and there is a suffering of conditioned existence, pervasive suffering of conditioned existence.
Which has to do with just a fundamental vulnerability to suffering altogether.
So for someone whose immediate concern is to really be relieved from evident suffering, to that person, you know, if you speak of the suffering of change, you know, that's completely beyond that individual person's kind of, you know, imagination.
It doesn't even see that as suffering.
So that person doesn't see that as a suffering. So for that person, you need a moderate amount of suffering that is, you know, evident suffering that is appropriate to that individual to gain resilience. Whereas for someone who has a deeper understanding of the nature of suffering from the Buddhist point of view and sees even the seemingly pleasurable experiences as ultimately being in the potential of, you know, leading to dissatisfaction, so which is the suffering of change. Now, to that individual, then there is a resilience to withstand, you know, much higher degree of suffering of the evident type, the more painful experiences, because that individual's capacity to withstand and confront suffering will be higher. So similarly, for a practitioner who is deeply convinced of the nature of suffering of conditioned existence, this pervasive suffering of existence,
and is totally focused on gaining liberation from it. So it's just totally focused on utter liberation.
Then for that individual, again, the resilience will be completely different, because that individual, in the course of his or her everyday life, whenever encounters suffering or adversities, will immediately recognize that as expression of the unenlightened existence. So long as I'm caught in this prison of unenlightened existence, these are expected, these are bound to happen. So with that kind of expectation, there will be a much greater resilience. So to conclude, it's very difficult to really objectify and say, this much suffering or adversity is good for resilience. Mm-hmm.
It's a level of sophistication that hasn't yet been broached in the Western literature, scientific literature on this topic.
His Holiness gave the example of the Bodhisattvas. They are, they are described as having the capacity to, even though they recognize, you know, the cyclic existence as, you know, subject to suffering, but because of the power of their compassion for the sentient beings, they deliberately embrace suffering in the course of their working, to fulfill their altruistic aspirations.
Your Holiness, another issue that we talked about that we'd like to raise is this. In the presentation that I gave this morning, we found an association between the number of hours that an individual has undergone mental training and a particular signal in the brain, and there was a fairly linear relation. In other research that I've conducted, in the study that I did with Jon Kabat-Zinn that you've heard about before, where we took novices and trained them for 2 months and looked at changes pre and post this 2 month training period. In that study, we obtained information from them on how often they practiced each day. And in that study, there was no association between the length of time that they reported themselves practicing and changes in brain signals that we measured. The findings on this issue so far are inconsistent and puzzling. And so we were interested in your comments about how we should think about mental training and whether the effects are linear or are nonlinear. Are there particular stages of development where linearities would be more expected? With each 100 hours, you expect an equal increment.
His
Holiness was saying that it's really difficult. Again, here, individual variations will really play a big role. Mm-hmm. Because one of the kind of, you know, optimal, or one could say the higher point of meditative state is referred to as the effortless state, where a single event can trigger that state that you normally, you know, consciously cultivate. So, for example, in the case of compassion for all beings, this very forceful compassion by a sight of a suffering being will immediately trigger this spontaneous, strong compassion. But in order to arrive there, one needs to go through a deliberate cultivation. So there's a whole process through which the individual will go. Now, how long that process will be required for someone to go from an initial state of totally effortful, deliberate, you know, cultivation through to progressively diminishing effort, and then ultimately culminating at a point where it is totally effortless, as a single event can, you know, trigger that experience, that will be totally, you know, different in the case of each individual.
I think the issue of linear development has not yet gotten through.
No.
I don't think so. We've not really yet translated or gotten the message across of the whole question about linear development, mm-hmm. that it takes a long time, or that the duration of how long it will take to get progress, that's clearly very, right. very uncertain. But the other question of linear development, if you right. practice 1 year, will you get 1 year's worth, and 2 years twice as much, and 3 years
wherever
three times
Wherever you started from.
Yeah. Wherever you started from, that's the real question.
Mm-hmm. Because earlier, His Holiness mentioned that the difference probably, one difference is that in the case of meditators, there was a much higher level of motivation, because it's a voluntary practice. Absolutely. Whereas when you have controlled subjects, you know, the initiative is not really coming from their side. So that may be one factor. So in the case of Tibetan meditators, say those who do 3 year retreats, you know, very long retreats, some of them could actually repeat this several times. So those who do so, you know, do repeat this several times, they're doing it with
very voluntarily.
Yeah, totally voluntarily and high level of motivation.
And so those who are doing even more than one, but doing two or three, then they're going to have even a stronger motivation, stronger motivation. So there's going to be a correlation there, not just how much time they put in, but why did they put in that time, and it's going to be a greater incentive. Mm-hmm. So that's going to play out in the data as well.
So even among the meditators, imagine someone who did this 3 times, so that's over 9 years. So if the quality of the meditation isn't that great, so if the person is reciting some mantras and then maybe sometimes grooming himself, you know, looking for lice or on especially important religious days, you know, playing ritual instruments and so on, then the effect probably wouldn't be that great, even though the individual, you know, spent nine years.
Rusty.